Welcome to Bible class. We're going to be continuing our ongoing series of the year on wisdom tonight. So for Bible class this evening, we've got our brother John McColl, who will be speaking to us on the theme of the wisdom of Joseph. And as an introduction to that study, we're going to take a reading from Genesis chapter 41 and verses 14 to 41. And I'll read that for you. So with that as an introduction, I invite our brother John to tell us his study on the wisdom of Joseph.
Thanks, Brother Sebastian, and good evening, everyone. Welcome, and thanks for coming out this evening. A bit of a cold night out, but always nice to come here. Spend some time together around the Word of God, which is great. I had contemplated reading all of that chapter, but there's so many things about the life of Joseph in regards to how he demonstrates the wisdom that he has and his trust and faith in God as well. I thought, well, we'd just do part of that chapter because we're going to be looking at some other chapters as well. Obviously all of the time of Joseph's life is recorded at the end of Genesis here, really from about Genesis 37 through to the end of the book. And so there's lots of chapters there for us to learn lots about. But the first thing I would say in regards to the wisdom of Joseph, three key things. Joseph trusts in God. Above all things, he trusts in God. He acknowledges God in all things throughout his life. A number of occasions where we'll see where, you know, just in that reading, where he acknowledges that God is the one who gives interpretations of dreams. And Joseph regularly seeks God's guidance in his own life. And these three things are really pivotal around our own faith and what we should be doing in our own lives as well. We should be trusting in God. We do acknowledge that God is the giver and provider of all things, and we should be seeking God's guidance through prayer in all events in our lives. I'll be spending most of the time in these last few chapters of Genesis. So if you've got your Bibles open, certainly keep them there. There's a few other references that I will go to that are in the New Testament, but you don't have to turn them up. I've got them on slides here. So just stay open in this section in Genesis. Let's do a bit of a brief history of Joseph's life and the events that he went through, because obviously we don't have the time to cover all of these in full detail. And look, these are fairly good Sunday school lessons. I think most of us should know them fairly well. Joseph is the 11th son of Jacob, the 11th of 12 sons, and he is Jacob's favourite son, and hence why Joseph gets this coat of many colours from Jacob. It's a gift, it's a special gift to him, to symbolise obviously Jacob's love for him, but also the importance of Joseph himself. He has these dreams about sheaves of wheat, bowing down to his sheave of wheat. He also has a dream about the sun, moon and stars bowing down to him. And it's interesting because he tells these dreams to his family. And we might think, well, that's probably not a very wise thing to do, was it, Joseph? Given that it immediately sort of ostracised him from the rest of his family. It put his brothers offside. Jacob did keep the dreams in mind, so Jacob, you know, didn't say anything harsh towards Joseph at all, but Joseph's brothers are immediately offside for it. And it sort of starts this conflict between him and his brothers. Hence why later on in life, not so far, around the age of 17, Joseph is then sold into slavery. His brothers, they probably, as typical older brothers, you know, they probably roughed him up a little bit and they throw him into a pit. There's some discussions, particularly led by Judah, in regards to whether they should kill him or not. And then they decide, they'll just sell him. He is sold for 20 pieces of silver. Certainly we see some comparisons there in regards to the Lord Jesus Christ, who in a way was sold by Judas for 30 pieces of silver. Joseph is sold to Midianite traders on their way to Egypt, and he is then sold to the captain of the guard, Potiphar. And we read about most of this in Genesis 37. Not long afterwards, he becomes the head of Potiphar's house. Potiphar sees that everything that Joseph does becomes, you know, fruitful, and Joseph seems to be a fairly wise sort of a guy, and Potiphar puts him in charge of all of his house. We'll cover this in a little bit more detail in a while. He then becomes tempted by Potiphar's wife, and she then falsely accuses him, and he would be around 25 years of age. We don't know exactly. There's not enough detail in the scriptures to tell us, but he's obviously somewhere in that 17 to 25 year age. She falsely accuses him. He's then thrown into prison. Not long after being in prison, the prison guard decides to put Joseph in control of all of the prisoners. He then interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker while he's in prison. By this time, he's probably around 28 years of age. The butler and the baker, the butler returns back to his role. The baker, he is then probably beheaded by a pharaoh. And Joseph asks the butler to remember him to Pharaoh. The butler doesn't to begin with, but sometime later he does. Joseph spends another 2 years in prison. By the time he's 30, finally he gets this opportunity to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. Pharaoh has the dream about the cows, the fat cows, and then the thin cows, and the thin cows eating the fat cows. Thin cows don't get any better. And also about the wheat. Similar sort of a story there. And as a result of this, Joseph is then put in charge of all of Egypt under Pharaoh, and he's 30 years of age. He has now spent 13 years in Egypt, hasn't seen his family in that time. As a result of being put in charge of all of this in Egypt, he gathers the harvest for 7 years. He then sells the grain for another 7 years afterwards during the drought when there's a famine. Jacob then sends 10 brothers to Egypt to buy grain. Oops, spelling mistake there. To get grain. So the 10 brothers come to Egypt. Joseph meets them for the first time then. He meets his 10 brothers. He accuses them of being spies. Simeon is then put into prison, and 9 of the brothers return to Jacob. Joseph meets his brothers for a second time, and after a bit he then makes himself known to them. And by this stage he's 39 years of age. So when he finally does get to see the rest of his family, and particularly his father Jacob, he's 39 years of age. So what's that? 22 years that he's gone without seeing them. So it's probably no surprise that his brothers didn't recognise him. The last time they saw him, he was 17 years of age, very, very young. 22 years later, of course, they're probably not going to recognise him too much. Plus, he's wearing very different attire. Finally, after this, Jacob and his family move to Egypt. So that's fairly brief sort of a history. Just got a map here, because it's interesting just to see where Joseph first travels. So to begin with, the family lives in Hebron. We read about the fact that his brothers took the flock to graze further up through Shechem and then ultimately to Dothan. Joseph goes up to Shechem and on to Dothan to meet his brothers. That's where they sell him to the traders, and he finds his way down into Egypt with the Midianite traders. Most likely, Joseph would have ended up in this place called Memphis. No, not Memphis from America, where Elvis Presley lived, but Memphis in Egypt. Now, I thought this was quite interesting because I hadn't realised that Memphis was the place. The city of Cairo wasn't named at that time. It was this city of Memphis. Cairo nowadays is this sort of, I suppose, the centre of Cairo is just in between Memphis and Heliopolis. But the size of Cairo now spans all of this area. It's a huge, sprawling city and covers all of that area now. The ruins of Memphis are still there. You can go there and see them. With it. So, yeah, just interesting to see. And then obviously later on, Joseph's brothers come down from Hebron, and that's most likely where they saw him and caught up with him. The other thing to point out here is that obviously this is the land of Goshen, and we'll talk about that a little bit later as well, through the Nile Delta there, where it spreads out, very green, fertile area, good for grazing animals. And up along the Nile itself is where a lot of crops are grown as well, because obviously the Nile floods every year, and hence good fertile ground for growing crops after it dries out as well. So I'm going to have a look at some of these events in a little bit of detail now, and we'll start to see where the wisdom of Joseph really comes out. The first one is around the wisdom with Potiphar's wife. This is mainly recorded in Genesis 39, verses 7 to 20. So if you just turn over to Genesis 39, we won't read all of it. We'll just read the first few verses here, from verse 7 to verse 10. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused, and said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. So a few interesting points to consider out of this little story of Joseph with this temptation with Potiphar's wife. The first point to note in verse 10 is it mentions, and day by day, or she spake to Joseph day by day about her desire for him and how she would like to spend some time with him. This immediately tells us that this event was not something that just sort of suddenly happened overnight. She had obviously been sort of coming on to Joseph for quite some time. Joseph had obviously had some idea about it. And we might think, well, why did Joseph sort of continue on? He continued to do his job in the house. Didn't Joseph feel, do we sort of think that perhaps Joseph was tempting the situation by still working in the house? Well, no, because at the end of verse 10, not only did he say that he did not want to lie by her, but it says, or to be with her. Joseph avoided being with her at all cost. So he knew what sort of a woman she was. He knew that she obviously fancied him, and he took steps to stay away from her. But it also gave him time to think about the situation that he was in. And this is part of the wisdom of Joseph, but also a very important lesson for us. Joseph had time to think of an escape plan. Joseph wasn't a silly man. He would have understood, yep, this woman has got a fancy for me. One day, it's likely to get out of hand. What am I going to do? And he would have had a plan in mind. And he executed that plan by simply running away from her. He ran away from temptation. Joseph refuses the advancements of this woman and he runs away. That in itself is a very wise move. He literally and physically ran away from sin and ran away from temptation. It was this temptation of a seductive woman that comes to him in a strange land. He's far away from his family. He's far away from his support group from a religious and spiritual point of view. He's in a strange land. And let's be honest, Potiphar's wife, she wasn't going to tell anybody what was going on. She was the only one in the house. No one else would have known. Joseph's family wouldn't have known about it. None of the guards or slaves would have. They weren't there in the house at the time. It would have been their secret and nobody else would have known. But here's the wisdom of Joseph. In verse 9, at the end of verse 9, he says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Although there was nobody else there, nobody else would have known, Joseph understood that God would have known. And he says to the woman, "This is a sin at God, sin to God if I do this." And so he runs away from it. The lesson for us from this is to plan ahead. Think about where we are going. Think about who we're going to be with and what we will be doing day by day. Think about, do I need to avoid temptation where I'm going today or tomorrow? And think about what could be my plan of escape if I have to. These temptations will come upon us in our lives. But as the scriptures tell us, God will always make a way of escape. The scriptures also tell us to flee from youthful lusts. We'll have a look at these two references. You don't need to turn them up. I've got them up on the slide here. The first one from 1 Corinthians 10, verses 13 and 14. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry." God will always make a way of escape. We don't have too many of our... I think we've got some real young ones here this evening, but not too many of our youth. But some of our youth, and I'm sure we might even remember ourselves when we were young, when our parents might have given us a bit of a hard time about things we might have been doing in our lives, and we might have replied to our parents going, "Oh, Mum, Dad, you don't know how it is. You don't know what it's like. Yours was a different generation." I love this verse here because it so clearly explains that there is no temptation that is going to come upon us that has not happened to somebody else before. There is no temptation in our lives that somebody else in this world has not encountered. In other words, we will not be tempted by something that no one else has ever been tempted by. We know that Jesus was tempted in all ways as we are, but without sin. All the temptations that we might face in our lives, Jesus has faced, and he did not succumb to them. But even if we put Jesus aside for a moment, all of the temptations that we encounter in our lives, somebody else has encountered, and somebody else has avoided them. Somebody else has recognized the way of escape. Certainly, no one else apart from Jesus has avoided all temptations, but I think it's good to know that somebody else has avoided the temptations that we might succumb to. Because I think that's important, where we can talk to each other about these things and find help and get support from each other. Because God has always made a way of escape with every temptation. We just have to be willing to take it, don't we? The other reference there in 2 Timothy, where Paul writes to Timothy, chapter 2, verses 22 to 25. Flee also youthful lusts, but follow righteousness, faith, charity, peace, with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strifes. And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient, in meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. If God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth. Let's be honest. All of us, in our youth, have most likely made mistakes in our lives. In our youth is the time when we are most likely to make mistakes. And Joseph, at this time, with Potiphar's wife, Joseph was in the highest risk age bracket for a man, 17 to 25. This age bracket is where men are the biggest risk takers. In our youth, we are most likely to be influenced by others around us, most likely to want to push the boundaries or push our point or our ideas, our views onto others around us. It's the time of our life that we are most likely to make mistakes. Paul, writing to Timothy, says, don't stir up trouble between friends. Don't start arguments. And stay out of other people's foolish arguments. He tells Timothy to show some meekness and patience for others. And Joseph had done the same thing with Potiphar's wife. I'm sure many times he said to Potiphar's wife, "This is wrong. Don't come near me. I'm not interested." Day after day, he would have said it. He gave her time. He was patient. But when it gets to the point where temptation becomes too much, then the only option is to just get out of there. Get out of the situation that we're in. It's the best option. Just like Joseph did, he ran away. That particular lesson always reminds me of a Sunday school lesson when I was going to Sunday school at Adelaide. I was probably around 14 or 15, and we had a class of just boys. And I do recall our brother Ian Dangerfield was our teacher at the time. And he went through this lesson. And I quite clearly remember him saying, "Lads, one day you might find yourself in a similar situation." And he said, "The best thing to do is to turn around and run away from it." And the lesson really stuck in my head. I'm sure at some stage it probably served me well, but it was quite a powerful lesson to think that sometimes in life, when we are faced with temptation, the best thing to do is to turn around and run away from the situation that we're in, to avoid it. Joseph did that, and unfortunately, Potiphar's wife falsely accuses him, and he's put into jail. In jail, Joseph finds favour with the keeper of the prison, and soon afterwards, he's put in charge of all the other prisoners. One day there are two new prisoners, the chief butler and the chief baker. Both have dreams, and Joseph, with the guidance of God, is able to explain and interpret those dreams for the baker and the butler. The butler is restored to his previous position and the baker is put to death, and Joseph remains in prison for another 2 years. At this point, I want to cover a number of sections of Joseph's life where Joseph always prospers. To begin with, under Potiphar, recorded there in Genesis 39 verses 1 to 6, where he becomes the overseer of the house. And all that he does prospers. In the prison, later on, he becomes the manager of the other prisoners. And it's interesting to see how Joseph's life has these ups and downs. They're quite extreme, aren't they? Even from when he leaves from his family, you know, his brothers sell him off, and suddenly he's in this very low part of his life. He ends up being sold to Potiphar, and after obviously a few years, he gets to this point of being the overseer of Potiphar's house. Really, you know, so much. Actually, I'll see if I can find the verse here. Chapter 39 and verse 6, where it says, "And Potiphar, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favoured." So Potiphar hands over the running of his house to Joseph. And Potiphar has no idea what Joseph's doing. As long as Potiphar gets his food, his bread, he's happy with what Joseph's doing. Joseph goes and runs the house. You think of the position that Joseph's now in, just in Potiphar's house. Unfortunately, things don't go right with Potiphar's wife, and then Joseph's back into prison, another low point of his life. Spends some time in prison, he then becomes the manager of all the other prisoners. Under Pharaoh, after Joseph gets out of prison, Pharaoh then exalts him to the point of being second in command in the whole of Egypt. Joseph becomes ruler over all Egypt, except for Pharaoh on the throne. Joseph then gathers the grain during the 7 years of plenty. And it gets to the point that they gather so much grain that they stop numbering how much grain. They stop counting it. They've gained so much in the 7 years. Obviously, to begin with, they did, but it just gets to the point where Joseph goes, "But it's become so plenteous that we're just not going to count it anymore." Everything he touches, he prospers. And then selling the grain, and we'll cover this in detail towards the end. He, as a result of selling the grain to all of the Egyptians first and then to all of the foreigners from other countries, Joseph ends up procuring all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh because he was able to sell the grain to the Egyptians. Everything Joseph touches prospers. And this is a lesson for us, that we should work as if we are working for God. Plenty of times in Joseph's life, he could have just stepped back and gone, "This isn't working. You know, I've been sold as a slave. Just forget it. You know, it's just not going to happen." He gets put into prison. He could have decided to give up there as well. He had plenty of opportunities where he could have stepped back and not taken these roles of responsibility. But he works. He continues in the work of God. There's a great bit of scripture from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 to 8, where Paul exhorts us, "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters, according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in singleness of your heart, as unto Christ, not with eye service, as men pleases, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service, as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free." I find that section of Scripture so well defines Joseph's life. There were times when Joseph was in bondage. There were times when Joseph was a free man. But all the time, Joseph worked as if he was working for the Lord. When Joseph gets out of prison and he goes to Pharaoh, Pharaoh sees the wisdom. And we know that Pharaoh has a dream. So come across to Genesis 41, the reading that we had. Genesis 41, verses 1 to 7, is where Pharaoh has the dream. Now, we're not going to read it. I think we know it fairly well. But we will have a look at verse 8. Verse 8, it says, "And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh." The reason I call out that verse is because not only could no one interpret the dreams, but the fact was that Pharaoh called the magicians and all the wise men. Pharaoh had already spoken to all of the wise men in Egypt, and they still couldn't interpret the dream. And then it's the butler who remembers that Joseph was the one who interpreted his dream, and that obviously his dream came true, that he was restored back to his position as the butler. And so Joseph is then called to interpret this dream for Pharaoh. If we have a look, but when Joseph comes, Joseph immediately acknowledges that God is in control. So we'll have a look at these verses. The first verse is 15 and 16. "And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace." So immediately he says the interpretation is going to come from God. Likewise, verse 25, "Joseph said unto Pharaoh, The dream of Pharaoh is one. God hath showed Pharaoh what it is about," or what he is about to do. And likewise, verse 28, "This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh." And also verse 32, "And for that dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice. It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." If Pharaoh hadn't got the message by now, you know, Joseph's really sort of laid it on there, clearly explaining that it is God's intention that these things will happen. And then from verses 33 to 36, Joseph recommends a plan to Pharaoh. He says, "Now therefore let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to take up a fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. And that food shall be for store in the land against the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine." Now, this is another, I think, quite important lesson for us. The wisdom of Joseph here. Not only does he go to Pharaoh and, by the grace of God, is able to explain to Pharaoh his dream and what the dream means, but he also comes with a suggestion on how to approach the problem. This, I think, is very relevant because we should remember this when we are talking not only to other people around us, because don't just go and point out somebody else's problem. If you're going to do that, think about an option for how they can work around the problem, and think about how you can help them work around that problem. Now, from a working environment, I see this quite often at work, and I've fallen for the trap myself as well. If we discover a problem within our IT networks at work, and I go to my manager and say, "Oh, we've found a problem, these servers are down," and he goes, "Yeah, okay, thanks, John. So what are you going to do about it?" I was like, "Oh, okay." Yeah. And he goes, "So what should I do about it, John?" And I've had managers say to me in the past, "John, don't come to me with a problem, come to me with a solution as well." And Joseph's done this for Pharaoh. He hasn't just explained the problem to Pharaoh, he's come to Pharaoh with a solution as well. Nothing impresses a manager or a boss more if when you go to them with a problem, you go to them with the solution or a suggestion for the solution as well. And this really does impress Pharaoh. Because as we see, Pharaoh acknowledges the wisdom of Joseph in verses 37 to 39. "And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, Can we find such a one as this? A man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Forasmuch as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art." That is in stark contrast to the fact that, to begin with, Pharaoh went and got all of his wise men from the country of Egypt. None of them could interpret his dream. And now Joseph comes along. Joseph acknowledges that the interpretations of dreams come from God. He explains the dream to Pharaoh, and he comes to Pharaoh with an option or a solution. That must absolutely blown Pharaoh away, that here was this guy who'd just come out of prison, and he's not only interpreted the dream, but got a solution for him. As a result, as we know, Pharaoh puts him in charge. So, the first point of this, the wisdom of gathering. He has 7 years to gather the harvest. The first part of this, in chapter 41 and verse 34. Did I get that? That's right. In verse 34, he says that they should appoint officers over the land and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the 7 plenteous years. So basically 20% of the harvest is given for storage. The food is then stored in the cities, as it's recorded in verse 35, to keep the food in the cities. So what was he doing here with this? In essence, as the old saying goes, he was saving for a rainy day, or in this case, he was saving for 7 years of drought. Joseph stored the food. So he was saving 20% of the grains of the harvest into the cities. This in itself, I think, is quite significant, in that Joseph has great faith and trust in God. But as we know, faith without works is dead. It's not enough just to trust that God is going to save us or provide for us. And what Joseph does here is an example of him actually putting his faith into action. You know, we can't just trust in God and then sit back and do nothing. We have to actually do something about it. God gives us the opportunities that we can actually support ourselves. Joseph is doing this by collecting all of the grains in readiness for the 7 years of drought. He also stores the food in the cities. If we do this as well in our lives, then it's important to protect our savings. Why was Joseph putting it into the cities? He could have as easily kept it out in the country areas as well. But in the cities, he can protect it. He can protect it from foreign invaders. He can also protect it from locals as well. Because, hey, people are people. And when it came to the 7 years of famine, if all of the grain was spread out throughout the countryside, then it would be very difficult to control. The wisdom of Joseph. He brings all of the grain into the big cities where there's plenty of soldiers who can properly guard it. What he was doing was like a type of superannuation. In other words, during the years, the 7 years when there was plenty, he was putting some aside, bit by bit. And then when it came, the 7 years of drought, there was something there for everyone to live off of. We do the same thing today with our own superannuation. It's quite interesting because Australia, like quite a number of countries, that there's actually a law around superannuation. If you have a reasonable working job, then you have to put money away for your retirement. When you get to an age where you can't work or it's difficult to work. Interesting that it's the same approach. Joseph established this, yeah, many thousands of years ago. So there was the 7 years of plenty. They put some stuff away in the stores, the grains, and then come the years of famine. Before we go into the detail of how Joseph sells the grain, I wanted to look at the wisdom that Joseph has with his brothers, because obviously Jacob up in Canaan, they have the drought as well, the famine's there. Jacob sends his sons down to Joseph to buy grain in Egypt, not knowing that it's Joseph. So, the first meeting with the 10 brothers in 42 verses 6 to 9. During this time, when the brothers come down, the 10 brothers bow down to Joseph in verse 6, and Joseph remembers his dream. If we have a look at that in chapter 42, and in verse 6, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and it was he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, Whence come ye? And they said, From the land of Canaan, to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. I find it interesting here that Joseph remembers his dream. And we'd have to ask, well, why didn't Joseph show himself to his brothers at this point? Because his brothers were bowing down to him, just like in his dream. The reason why he doesn't reveal himself now, there's a couple of reasons. The first obvious one is, there's only 10 brothers here. His dream was that 11 sheaves bowed down to his. So Joseph remembered his dream, and I'm sure it brought his dream right to the forefront of his mind where he saw his brothers bowing down to him. He must have gone, the dream! No, hang on, there's only 10 of them. In the dream, there was 11. So what's Joseph doing now? Here, he ends up accusing them of being spies. He orders the brothers to bring Benjamin, and he keeps Simeon. Joseph asks the brothers about their father and if they have a brother as well. And we don't really learn this until we get over into Genesis 43. We'll talk about this in a minute. But you think about all these things that Joseph is doing to his brothers. It's almost like he's giving them a hard time. And you think, yeah, that's a little bit rough. But once again, it's the wisdom of Joseph. He's actually building a case to prove that he is Joseph. He could have right up front and said, hey brothers, it's me, Joseph. And they would have gone, nah, what do you know about us? You don't know anything about us. We have come from Canaan. You don't know who our brother is. What Joseph's doing is all of these events, he's planting the seed in their mind. He's giving them the evidence up front before he reveals himself. We'll have a look at these in a little bit of detail. I wanted to briefly have a look at this bit in Genesis 43, verses 6 and 7. This is after the nine brothers. So Joseph keeps Simeon. The nine brothers go back to Jacob. We'll just read these ones. So Jacob, or as his name is, Israel, says, and Israel said, wherefore dealt ye so ill with me? Jacob's talking to the nine brothers now. He says, wherefore dealt ye so ill with me as to tell the man whether ye had yet a brother? And they said, the man asked us straitly of the state of our and of our kindred, saying, is your father yet alive? Have ye another brother? And we told him according to the tenor of these words. Could we certainly know that he would say, bring your brother down? I think it's a great little insight into the conversation that Joseph was having with his brothers. You could imagine that just to begin with, you know, just casually Joseph would have gone, oh, there's 10 of you. Have you got any more brothers? Knowing full well that they did. Oh, is your father still alive? He's planting the seed all the time. But I love how Jacob says, you know, why did you tell him that you've got another brother? Obviously, Benjamin being so close to Jacob. Jacob had already lost Joseph. He didn't want to lose Benjamin as well. And he says to the other nine, why on earth did you tell this man in Egypt that you've got another brother? And now he wants Benjamin to go as well. You can almost feel the anguish there with Jacob. Eventually they do run out of grain and they have to go back to Egypt to buy more. The second meeting with his brothers later on in this chapter 43. When they return with Benjamin this time, before they see Joseph, they talk with the steward first. And they explain that they ended up with all of their money back and this sort of thing. And the steward says, it's okay, no problems. No, we had your money. And then the steward brings Simeon out to them. So now there is 11 brothers together. And in verse 26. And Joseph came home, and they brought him the present, as in his brothers, which was in their hand, into the house, and bowed themselves to him, to the earth. Now there are 11 brothers bowing to Joseph, just as his dream was. Fascinating to see that on their return, they end up seeing the steward first, and Simeon is brought back out so that the 11 of them could be together when they first see Joseph. The other fascinating thing here, the brothers dine in order of age, verse 33. And they sat down before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marvelled one to another. Once again, it's just another piece of evidence that Joseph was putting before them. How did he know their order of age? And then the silver cup is placed in Benjamin's bag, and they return. All of them return, too. All 11 of them return. And then there's this third meeting. Because on the return, the brothers are caught out, the silver cup is identified, they're accused of being thieves, they come back, And they bow down to Joseph again in chapter 44 and verse 14. And Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. So it's essentially three times that the brothers bow down to Joseph. Judah then pleads for the release of Benjamin in verses 18 to 34. And Judah offers to take the place of Benjamin later on. So, of course, the silver cup was put into Benjamin's bag, and Joseph says, he's guilty, he stays here with me as my servant, the rest of you can go back. And Judah steps forward. And it's fascinating to see that, because it was Judah back in chapter 37 that said, let's sell Joseph to the Midianites. Let's get rid of him. We don't want him. And now Judah steps forward. Judah acknowledges that Benjamin is special to Jacob. And Judah knows that if he returns without Benjamin, that it'll be the end of Jacob. And Judah acknowledges what he's done wrong in his life. And that's what Joseph was looking for. So finally, at this point, then after all these little bits of evidence that Joseph put before them, Joseph then goes, brothers, it's me. And without a doubt, it would have been an absolute shock to them. Joseph, hang on a minute. But then it wouldn't have taken too long for them to go, hang on, we all bowed down to him. He put us all in order of age when we sat down at the table. He asked about the fact that we had a brother. He asked about our father. Of course, Joseph and Jacob had a close bond. Of course he would have been asking about Dad all the time. All these little bits of evidence is what Joseph put before them, so that when Joseph finally revealed himself, they knew that it was Joseph, even though they wouldn't have recognised him. Now comes the bit that I actually like out of this story that really sort of brought a lot of things to life. The wisdom of selling in Genesis 47. What we'll do is we'll actually read these verses and then we'll sort of come back and touch on a few of them. So Genesis 47, verses 13 to 26. And there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in all the land of Canaan, for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. And Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if the money fail. And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of herds and for the asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. And when that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, we will not hide it from my lord, how that our money is spent. My lord also has our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate. And Joseph brought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to the cities, from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them. Wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have brought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. And it came to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for them of your households, and for food of your little ones. And they said, Thou hast saved our lives, let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which become not Pharaoh's. So let's have a look at some of the key points out of this. Joseph ends up gathering all of the money of Egypt. He has so much corn, or so much grain and stuff, and people are so desperate for it, that they end up paying all of their money in the first few years. The money runs out, the money becomes worthless. They then give their cattle and all of their flocks to Joseph, and Joseph gives it all to Pharaoh so that they can buy grain for their families. The cattle and the flocks, they run out, and the people come along and say, we've got nothing else left, but we're still hungry. The famine's still going to go on for years. All we've got is ourselves and our land. They sell the land to Joseph as well, and Joseph buys all of the land, gives it to Pharaoh. Pharaoh owns everything in Egypt because of Joseph. Joseph then removes the people from the land. Now you might think, that's a little bit of an odd thing to do. Once again, there's wisdom in this. Because they had sold the land, Joseph wanted to get them off the land, get them out of the land, because he had to disassociate them from the land. If you leave people on the land and say, well, yeah, the land belongs to us, but you can stay there, they still feel some ownership to it. Joseph wants to change the way the country runs. So he takes them off the land, brings them into the cities. Then he gives the people grain to go out and replant. I have no doubt that he did not give them the same blocks of land that they had in the past. He gave them different blocks of land. And we'll see why in a moment. So the people end up becoming servants of Pharaoh. The people work, they can work the land for Pharaoh. The people must give 20% of the crop to Pharaoh as they work the land. Right? Essentially, Joseph has introduced a taxation system. The people are sent out with something to grow. As they grow, they have to pay for the use of the land to Pharaoh. It's a taxation system. It is still with us today. We all pay taxes when we work. Interesting, the priests are exempt from the tax system. And that was a law that Joseph puts in place and that Pharaoh accepts, because the priests were special. Now, these were the priests of Egypt, and yes, they were pagan, but they were the religious leaders of the time within Egypt. Interesting, the same law exists in our country now. Joseph made a law that is still with us, that religious and non-profit organisations can be exempt from paying tax. We are exempt from paying tax in many aspects. We can apply not to have to pay the tax. And I think that's fascinating that Joseph set up this law 3,700 years ago, and it's still with us today. And as the scripture said there, that the laws were still with them until that day as well. So what was the difference then? When Joseph took all of the people off the land and then gave them corn, gave them grain and stuff, and said, okay, you can go out and plant it all. So crops are grown along the Nile plains. Joseph wanted to get all of the Egyptians back to planting crops along the Nile. Mind you, that's what the Egyptians wanted to do. They had already sold everything they had. They'd given over their money, they'd given over their cattle and flocks, They give over their land, they give themselves up as servants, and Joseph says, right, you can go and grow grain now along the Nile. And you notice, in the bit of scripture we read there, they don't get their cattle or flocks back. They only get grain to go and farm grain. Huh? Animal grazing is best done in the land of Goshen. Originally, there would have been Egyptians in the land of Goshen as well, because it was a great spot to have animal grazing. Hence why Joseph pulled all of the Egyptians off the land, brought all of the Egyptians into the cities, and then gave them grain and said, go and plant it down along the Nile. Joseph's family are shepherds. This is great. Come to this verse, back to Genesis 46, verse 31. After Jacob and the rest of his family come down, before they meet Pharaoh, Joseph primes them up with what to say. And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh, and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which are in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all they have. And it shall come to pass, when Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation? That ye shall say, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and also our fathers, that ye may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So the Egyptians actually didn't like shepherds very much. There's some other historical reasons there, but the Egyptians go off to plant corn and stuff, and then all of a sudden his family roll up, and they're all shepherds. And when they go and meet Pharaoh, so we'll continue on the next few verses. In chapter 47, and then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, my father and his brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. And they said, moreover, unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land are we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. And Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. The land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle as well. So you think how clever Joseph was, how wise was he. He sold all of the grain to the Egyptians. First, he sold it for all of their money. And then he sold them grain for all of their cattle and their flocks. And then he buys all of their land. He moves the Egyptians off the land into the cities. He gives them grain back. And they go and plant it along the Nile towards the south. And he gives all of this stuff that he's gained is Pharaoh's. So Pharaoh's got all of the money of the land of Egypt. He's got all of the flocks. He owns all of the land. And Joseph's family comes and they present themselves to Pharaoh as being shepherds. Pharaoh's got all of these cattle. So he says to Joseph, they can live in the land of Goshen. And by the way, if there's some good shepherds there, let them look after my cattle as well. The wisdom of Joseph. Very clever, I think, how it all sort of worked out there. Pharaoh gives them the land of Goshen to live in. Now, why was that important? The last little lesson here. So here's a little map of the land. All right. It says that they actually went to the area of Ramesses, which is up there in the land of Goshen. That was the area. Here's Memphis. So all the way down the south is where the Egyptians would have gone and planted grains, and the Israelites are now located up here. Very clever how Joseph actually separated the Israelites from the Egyptians. It meant that the Israelites were in the land of Egypt, but they weren't necessarily of the land of Egypt. They didn't have to dwell with the rest of the Egyptians. Later on, things got a little bit mixed up, but the fact is that they were quite separated from the rest of them. And Pharaoh gave them the land quite willingly. So, let's just recap on the lessons for us. First of all, in regards, we should trust in God, even when things don't appear to be going good for us. We should seek guidance and wisdom from God in all aspects of our lives. And we should work as if we are working for God. Work with honesty and integrity and commitment in our jobs. We should plan ahead in this life and for the life to come. It is okay to put money away for a special day. It is okay to plan for the future, because we don't know when Christ is going to return. Don't just point out people's problems. Think about a solution and how you can help if you approach someone with a problem. Because remember, faith without works is dead. It's not enough to just trust in God that God is going to deliver us. We need to put our faith into action, just like Joseph did. And more importantly, we must have faith. But we must still get on with this life. We must work to support ourselves and our families. We do have to build homes to live in. We have to obtain food and education, planning for our lives now, but always we should be watching for the return of Christ. Thank you.